I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I'm just wondering if you can think of an upside to the word invasion. Well, generally speaking, invade, invasion, invaders, those words all have pejorative connotations. It's a heavily loaded term. When we think about an ecosystem being invaded, we immediately think about various species that displace or upset other species that were there first, and you have the newcomers, and the newcomers interrupt healthy patterns and cycles. Meanwhile, I've got to say this, I've always liked the expression, it's complicated. We say it's complicated whenever we want to signal that there's actually more to the story, or that things aren't just as cut and dried as you'd think. And we have such a story for you right now. It has to do with donkeys and water and a kind of disruption or intervention or, okay, I'll just say the word, fair or unfair, I'm going to say it, an invasion of donkeys. And this invasion might just prove to have an upside where these donkeys have shown up as non-natives in an ecosystem and perhaps have done some good. With us right now is Erik Lundgren. He is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Biology at Aarhus University in Denmark. Erik Lundgren, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's really great to be here. And thanks for that wonderful introduction to this topic.
Well, that word, invasion, people kind of toss that around. And I understand there is such a thing as an invasive species. I don't know if the donkeys we're going to be talking about qualify in that category. Do they?
Well, many biologists would say that they're invasive species. I come from a school of thought that finds the term invasion to be very unscientific and really more of a emotional, anthropomorphic metaphor that allows us to externalize our own guilt onto other organisms and not look at the ecology of these systems as they actually are.
Okay, I'm going to work with that in just a moment here. Let's talk donkeys, though, shall we? Where are the donkeys that you have observed? When did you start observing them? What were they doing? And why were they of interest to you in the first place?
You know, I was working as a field biologist in Arizona, and I happened to be working in a system with lots of feral donkeys, wild burros. And they really are fascinating. I mean, we have these wild equids that are thriving in these extremely hot deserts. And one aspect that, you know, piqued my interest was knowing that North America used to have 3 to 5 species of horse, of equid, up until 10,000 years ago when humans arrived. And so seeing these introduced donkeys really, you know, raises the question of like, what are they doing? Especially when you broaden your time scales of these ecosystems and think about how they were before humans arrived.
So these donkeys are left behind by the Spanish colonizers? I'm just guessing.
You know, that wild horses in North America, some of them descend from Spanish colonizers, but a lot of these donkeys are more recent. They were used in the mining industry and traveling by prospectors through the deserts. And then, you know, when we got internal combustion engines, diesel, and a lot of the mines closed, the miners just let these animals go. And they've done great. They know how to live in these very hot, dry conditions.
So you're telling me that there are donkeys in the southwestern part of the United States that just as recently as 150 years ago or so, with prospectors looking for gold or silver or copper or whatever they were prospecting for, when they were done with the donkeys, they just cut them loose.
Exactly.
Yeah. How many of these do you come face to face with in your field research? I mean, I have no idea how many, or are they few and far between? Do you have to look for them?
You kind of have to look for them. And they have all sorts of mysterious patterns. Like they use some areas and avoid others. And sometimes you can see their sign, but it's like they're ghosts and you'll be lucky to see one. And then other times you walk right into a herd and they'll scare you to death because they'll start screaming, and they usually see you first. So yeah, there's a lot of questions about them and why they're in certain places and not others and all that kind of fun stuff.
Now, the thing that we got to get to right away is If they were not originally there, these more modern donkeys, we're not going to talk back in, you know, ancient history at this point. But we'll get to that. We're going to get to those early equids. I like saying equids. That's kind of fun.
me too.
These donkeys, they dig up the ground. And that is kind of – they make, you know, fairly conspicuous wells. I guess they got a drink.
Exactly. These are big animals and they need surface water. And they're very good at digging. And they do something that the native species, which are generally smaller, don't do, which is digging to groundwater. And so these, you know, this is the first thing I saw, and this is something that elephants do in Africa. And it's considered critical to maintaining surface water in Africa. And these, so you go to these systems and you'll find these wells, sometimes meter and a half deep. They have been described digging as deep as 2 meters. And these wells are, ubiquitous in these systems, and they're used by everything. You'll be there and there'll be birds flying in to drink and ground squirrels. And I put trail cameras up, and these wells are used by nearly every vertebrate you can imagine. And it's, you know, it's really remarkable is because our narratives about invasion have prevented us from actually seeing this. So it's, even though everyone knows it's happening, no one's been applied any scientific curiosity to it, because it doesn't fit into our paradigms.
So does your field work entail going out, finding these wells that have been dug by the donkeys or the burros, and mapping them and charting them and setting up cameras? I mean, what's the scope of what you were doing to ascertain that, number one, this was going on? Did, I mean, and also, did somebody tip you off that this was going on?
No, I was stunned to see it for the first time, you know, and it, this was long before I went to graduate school, when I was just a, you know, a wee kid, basically, in my early 20s. And it really filled me with a, you know, burning curiosity. And I began going out to these systems and putting out trail cameras on these wells and then mapping the amount of water. So, you know, in the desert, water is very variable. It depends on precipitation. And it also changes through the season. So in the hottest times a year, water is generally pretty scarce because trees are using it and the water table drops, and because it's not raining. And so I wanted to understand whether this behavior actually had the potential to influence the amount of water, the persistence of water in these ecosystems through time. So I would go out for the summer, and I brought some undergraduate volunteers with me in extremely hot conditions. They were a heroic bunch. And we would go and map these sites and put up cameras and try to understand how this behavior was influencing the persistence of water in these ecosystems.
So how far and wide did you travel? Were you in the Mojave Desert? Were you clear over in Texas? Where were you?
You know, mostly in the Sonoran Desert. I was going to Arizona State University in Phoenix at the time. And so most of our sites were, you know, a couple hours away. But I've been doing more work recently further up in the Mojave Desert near Death Valley, and you'll see the same behavior in those regions as well. So I added a few additional field sites over the last couple of years that are included in this recent publication.
Now, we talked a little bit earlier about this term invasion, and you said that it is maybe a kind of a rhetorical, you know, emotionally laden term. You make a distinction between the term invasive species and introduced species. Is that more scientific to talk about an introduced species?
I think so. I mean, when you talk about an introduced species, you're simply describing, without asserting, you know, a value hierarchy, that an organism's dispersal included human assistance. You know, the biodiversity, the organisms that are here all arrived at some point. The reason we have biodiversity in the first place is through dispersal. And some of that dispersal has been mediated by, you know, when you think about plants on islands, those plants got there from birds, or from drifting. And humans are just another force like that, just like these birds that carry seeds. And so introduction, saying introduced, is a way more neutral and term for this process of, you know, redistribution of life, which is happening right now. When you use a more neutral term, it allows you to see the phenomena you're studying more clearly. It allows you to test hypotheses that wouldn't fit in the narrative of invasion.
Well, let's go beyond just mere neutrality from the dark side of things to the bright side of things. You make a case, or it seems that you kind of at least lean that direction to say that there's been some great benefit from the donkeys digging these wells. How are you measuring that, and what's the extent of the benefit?
Well, you know, I avoid using the term benefit as a scientist, but you know, this is that's a philosophical question. I don't want to distract from what you're asking. But just to continue that for a moment, science can tell you whether something is dry or wet, or green or red, or covered in plant life or not. But it can't tell you whether any of those conditions are good or bad. Those are ultimately ethical decisions. In our case, we see very clearly that the amount of water in these ecosystems is influenced by wild burros and horses as well in some places through this well digging behavior. And we see in the data very clearly that many, many animals use these features. And we can leave it at that. As a human being, it's hard not to see that as a benefit. But as a scientist, you can't really claim that. You can only claim that it is.
Right. And well, I'm not a scientist, so I have the luxury of being able to botch this, you know. And what I see from my value system, from my philosophical angle, to me, there's nothing wrong with greater bioabundance and greater biodiversity. And if I'm looking at a landscape that's fairly monochromatic, and then suddenly there's a well dug by a burro, and you suddenly have maybe an increase in maybe birds in the area, or some kind of vegetative growth in the area where there was – where before it was tightly, you know, circumscribed to some thistles and sagebrush and to me, a bioabundance and biodiversity, those are good. That's benefit.
I mean, I agree. I personally agree, but it gets dicey sometimes. Just as a side, I don't want to distract from the point of this, but if you think about redwood forests, for instance, they have extremely low biodiversity. And if we lived in a world where we, you know, dogmatically said biodiversity is good, then the best thing to do would be to clear cut redwood forests. And so it can be risky to not think critically about these values. And right, just recognizing right, that they're values and not science.
Right, right. Well, so then you're just observing phenomena and trying to be neutral about it. What's the craziest thing you ever saw turn up to these water holes with your cameras?
We had black bears. We had, just a diversity of migratory birds, including things I wouldn't expect in these deserts, like juniper titmouses and scrub jays and tons of orioles and tanagers. And, you know, just the activity rates were just so astounding. All day long and all night long, these wells are being used by various animals. And when you're there, these birds are flying in and drinking at your feet, which just really goes to show how important these features are for the living beings in these systems and for the biodiversity of these systems.
Yeah. Is there anything that happens on a large scale in a desert environment like this where you could say that by exposing water that's not apparent there at the surface, but the donkeys are digging down and the water suddenly is revealed? Is there anything big that's happening to change the dynamic of a region? I mean, there's got to be a tipping point at which time you say, okay, that particular species has crowded out another. You know what I mean?
The burros, the donkeys have crowded out another?
Well, no. If I were to talk about cheatgrass in the American West, if I were to talk about yellow toad flax in the American West, if I were to talk about spurge, and I'm talking about plants because I'm more familiar with plants, we talk about some things show up and they thrive and they're non-native. And they spread just with such rapidity that it crowds out some of the native stuff. I'm wondering if you've seen that kind of a tipping point as it relates to the donkeys and digging in the West.
Well, you know, I've seen there are areas, especially further north in the Mojave Desert, where there are so many donkeys that you really don't see other big mammals, which is really interesting, right? But it doesn't mean it's unnatural. you see the same types of dominance hierarchies between organisms in Africa where big animals have survived. And so I'm, you know, some of my research right now is looking at how predation by mountain lions actually mediates those interactions. In Death Valley National Park, there's widespread predation of wild donkeys. And in the sites that are really risky for donkeys, there's way more vegetation, the donkeys are there way less often, and there's more activity and diversity of other smaller mammal species because they suddenly have this time available without these sites being occupied by these big donkeys. So that's, you know, there are a lot of ways to understand these moments where an introduced species or a native species becomes numerically dominant and displaces other organisms. And there's one way to look at it through invasion biology, which is that these organisms are intrinsically different because they didn't co-evolve here. They don't belong here. And so they're under different rules. Or you can study them under the same old ecology rules that we know from native ecosystems, which is where certain functional traits predispose these organisms to do really well in certain environments. Or perhaps there's altered ecological contexts, like the persecution of mountain lions, or in the case of plants, historic grazing or damming of rivers that lead to the proliferation of a particular species that happens to be introduced because it can tolerate those new conditions really well.
I want to talk more with you about this whole kind of the philosophy of what's going on here. And I think the fun thing that's coming up is we're going to be talking about way back in time, in prehistory, and large mammals, megafauna that may have roamed in North and South America, and how some of these extinct species potentially, by their absence, have a function of theirs has disappeared that maybe something like a donkey could pick up on and fill a gap, as it were. We're going to talk more about that. We might even talk about hippos in Colombia as we come back to our conversation with Eric Lundgren in just a moment. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to have Eric Lundgren with us. We've been talking about donkeys that dig wells, feral donkeys in the American Southwest, and what that has done to the ecosystem and how we might think about all of this and introduced species that can't quite be called native to the area, if you're talking about donkeys in particular. But historically, there's another story to be had, and we're going to go back and talk about that. But first, Eric Lundgren, by the way, is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Biology at Aarhus University in Denmark, spends a lot of time doing field research in the American Southwest. Eric, there's a kind of a parallel story that emerged several years ago out of Colombia in South America, where there was a notorious drug dealer, one of these cartels, and one of the drug lords, Pablo Escobar. Apparently he had his own private zoo and he had imported hippos. And upon his demise, the hippos got loose. What happened then?
They started to do well. It's really a remarkable and very strange story of our modern life, right? Colombian cocaine dealer, Pablo Escobar, infamous, with his private collection of animals. And then when he was killed, they left the hippos on the property. And these hippos began breeding and began disappearing into the river. And now I'm not sure what the latest estimates are. Maybe around 100 animals are in this river system. And they're showing up 200 miles away, or at least 150 miles away, which is really incredible to see this giant animal, one of the biggest animals left on the planet, that's endangered in its native range, suddenly thriving in South America.
And for a hippo to thrive in Colombia might not be a good thing in some people's estimation, but then other people say it's not such a bad thing either. And I guess this has been fairly contentious.
Extremely contentious. And there's ultimately many, many layers to this. If you study what those hippos are doing in South America, without approaching it from the perspective that it has to be wrong by definition because they were introduced, you'll probably see lots of really interesting nuanced effects on Colombian ecosystems. You know, in Africa, hippos are part of this really important movement of nutrients from upland areas where they graze into river systems. And that actually boosts fish production. It can also lead to, systems crashing if there's too much feces in a small isolated water hole. So just like in Africa, the effects of hippos in Colombia are likely to be complicated, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be bad. And that badness, as we spoke about earlier, is really ultimately up to us, how we define good and bad as human beings with our various values. There are more complicated implications, of course, regarding how these organisms interact with humans. And I'm stunned by the fact that the Colombian people very strongly denounced the government's plan to kill these animals and wanted them protected, which suggests to me that there are a lot of people in this world that are willing to live around dangerous animals and to try to learn to coexist, which is the only way, ultimately, we're going to inherit a planet where there's still big animals left.
Yeah. You know, not all that many years ago, I interviewed a woman very well known in England for her project of rewilding thousands of acres. I don't remember, 15, maybe, I don't remember how many thousands of acres, a farm in the southern part of England. Isabella Tree is her name.
Yeah.
And she kind of learned about some functions that were performed in prehistory by very large oxen. I think it was called the aurochs or something like that.
Yeah, the aurochs.
And you can't get those anymore because they're extinct. But on this property, to try to at least resemble, to approximate a more wild kind of ecosystem, she brought in some very large mammals. And these mammals, from pigs to deer to cattle, they turn up the soil, they dig in the soil, they muck things up, and they poop on the soil. And in the process, there is greater bioabundance, greater biodiversity. And these all seem to be, at least from her perspective, kind of a success story on her terms of what rewilding might be. Now, the reason I mention that is because this hippo in the Magdalena River in Colombia, or the wild feral donkeys in the American Southwest, or the aurochs substitute, the imposter there in England, all of these stories are parallel to each other. And then you fold in an extra story which has to do with the disappearance of large megafauna. And tie that in for me, if you would. Why are you so interested in what was going on in the late Pleistocene era?
Yeah, it really is. When you start thinking about the late Pleistocene and about Earth's history in general, a really profound pattern shows up. You know, 66 million years ago or so, the dinosaurs go extinct, as we know. And then mammals begin to evolve into larger body sizes. From being very small-bodied, we suddenly get animals that are huge, only about 30 million years ago. And around 5 million years ago is when most modern plant species and small mammals show up on the fossil record, pretty much unchanged for the last 2 to 5 million years. And throughout all of that evolutionary history, the world was dominated by beasts, big animals, that do things that today we see as novel, like digging and pooping and eating trees to the ground, knocking things over, creating trampled bare ground. And that's actually the context under which life evolved. And it changed extremely recently ago in geologic time. As humans left Africa, there was a wave of extinctions that correspond tightly to the arrival of human beings in Australia, in North and South America, and then on various islands where big animals survived until humans arrived sometimes 500 years ago, and then they disappeared. And so when you think about that broader context, it really makes you wonder about what we think is good and how we understand these introduced megafauna that, you know, may seem really novel. You look at an area with a lot of wild donkeys, for instance, and there's a lot of grazing pressure and there's a lot of poop. And from the context that we grew up in, where we think that these ecosystems should be quiet and still and tranquil and undisturbed, it looks novel. It looks like a damage. But it's actually way more similar to how things were for almost ever, which is really, it changes your perspective and it allows you to be a little more curious when you see these phenomena that seem so out of place. And it also, when we look at what these animals did in the late Pleistocene, people know really well that they reduced wildfire, that they kept forests open. And many of these introduced species have been shown to do the similar things. Introduced water buffalo in northern Australia reduce wildfire rates and intensity, and actually facilitate the establishment of canopy trees by reducing wildfire by grazing these really unpalatable grasses that the smaller kangaroos can't eat. And then in my research with, you know, these desert systems, we know that many megafauna that were once ubiquitous dig wells, primarily various elephant-like animals and equids. And so the return of these donkeys and these horses in North America, which used to have several species of mammoth and 3 to 5 species at least of equid, suggests that this kind of behavior of digging to groundwater was once a real part of these ecosystems for millions and millions of years.
So one more comparison for you. If we think about the donkeys, that was kind of an accidental experiment that happened. There are much more intentional experiments that happen with, say, the reintroduction of wolves to their historic ranges in and around, say, you know, Yellowstone, Montana, up in the north, that sort of thing. Are you maybe saying that you are a little more open to some of this experimentation? I'm calling it experimentation, but like I say, some of it's intentional, some of it's not. You feel like there might be a little more wiggle room for this than is often said to be the case.
Yeah, I guess I believe that we should study the world as it is with open curiosity. You know, wild donkeys and horses have been studied as pests. And when you study something as a pest, you really know what you're going to find. You're documenting harm. You've already defined the conditions of the research that anything they do is by definition harmful. And so I think we should study these animals as wildlife. The same rules that influence how white-tailed deer, for instance, in the Northeast, where there's no predators and they're very abundant, those same rules are the rules that are influencing wild donkeys and horses, of course, different for species. But we can understand these things mechanistically and as wildlife, and and in doing so, really understand the world better. Deciding that these organisms are pests and then going in and doing research really just tells us what we already knew. You know, the return of wolves to Yellowstone is an incredible thing. And we learned so much about how the world works from it. But there's also ethical elements to reintroduction projects that I find challenging. You know, we reintroduce an animal and then no one around the landscape tolerates them. So you basically took a family from a safe area, stole them from their home, and then doomed all their children to getting shot. Those types of projects, I think, need to be coupled with really thinking about how, you know, human tolerance for wildlife and how we can learn as a culture and as economies to coexist.
Remarkable conversation about such important issues, and a delight to have a chance to visit with you about it. I know more about donkeys in the American Southwest than I ever knew before. And one more thing I absolutely must ask you. How's the water down there? I understand you've actually sipped from one of those donkey wells.
Oh, it's delicious. I mean, I avoid the ones that they just drank out of because it's sometimes a little saliva. But if you go to ones that haven't been used super recently, the water is crystal clear, generally pretty cold. It tastes great. And it's also filtered by all that sand, so I feel pretty safe drinking from it.
Okay. Yeah, the hygiene is a big issue right there. Eric, a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's been a great conversation.
Eric Lundgren with us. He's a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Biology at Aarhus University in Denmark. What use is a donkey? We still haven't completely settled that question. Well, in the desert, wild donkeys dig wells. That's worth something. But what should you do with an abused, neglected, domestic donkey just looking for a purpose in life? Not named Eeyore, by the way. This one's named Sherman. We're going to learn about Sherman next on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Just when you thought there's very little more to say about donkeys, we do have some more to say about donkeys. Donkeys get a bad rap, I think. They're known for being stubborn. I don't know if it's technically correct or even PC to call a donkey mulish, but they're generally thought to be stubborn, and dull. The word asinine, meaning exceedingly stupid and foolish. Well, guess what? It comes directly from donkeys. I looked it up to make sure. It is. It comes from that word. But one of my colleagues here at Constant Wonder has shown me a picture of a rescued donkey adopted by a friend of his. And I have to say, it's one of the most adorable faces I've seen on an animal in a very long while. I really had no idea donkeys could be so charismatic. Big fuzzy ears, wide eyes outlined in white eyeliner, a soft white muzzle. And I'm going to be guilty here of anthropomorphizing a little bit. This particular donkey in the photo I'm looking at has a deeply sincere and innocent expression. I think if you crossed a koala, an Ewok, and a horse, you'd probably get something like a donkey. Well, maybe there's a reason even that Mary on her way to Bethlehem is traditionally portrayed riding a donkey. And donkeys do get a preferred spot in those nativity scenes I've seen. Well, what use is a donkey to us today? That was the challenge faced by our next guest. Christopher McDougall is a writer and journalist who gained fame 10 years ago with his runaway title, Born to Run. He has a new book titled Running with Sherman, and Sherman, it turns out, is a rescued donkey who probably needed a purpose in life. Christopher McDougall's on the line with us. Chris, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much. I am constantly wondering why I didn't talk to you before I titled this book, because now I want to call it What Do You Get When You Combine an Ewok, a Koala, and a Horse?
It's perfect. It's perfectly true, isn't it?
there are these moments as a writer where you listen to somebody else and you think, I missed an opportunity. And this is one of them.
Well, I've missed the opportunity of being anywhere near donkeys in my lifetime, except for one time. I hiked the Grand Canyon, and on a hike, we passed a train of donkeys. And I thought to myself right then, you're not going to catch me in this place on that animal. It was just too frightening. You've seen that or heard about that?
Well, yeah. Well, no, it's interesting because that is exactly, you really kind of pinpointed the whole genesis of that asinine, stubborn ideology about donkeys. The reason why you want a donkey in a place that's really treacherous is because donkeys make up their own minds. You can't force a donkey to do anything, which is why if you're on a really hazardous, narrow trail above a 10,000-foot drop, you can persuade a horse to do something stupid. You can spur it, you can whack it, and a horse will follow your orders. If a donkey isn't 100% confident that it's making the right move, it won't move at all. So I would say if you had to be on top of anything in a life-threatening situation, a donkey is your best bet.
Well, it seems to me that in your life, there was a shift that happened some point where you said, I'm going to welcome a donkey into my life. And that just doesn't seem like a normal kind of life experience for most people.
No, not at all. And not even for me. And I'm not sure if welcoming a donkey into my life was exactly the kind of context. What happened was, you know, almost 20 years ago now, we moved from Philadelphia way out into the Amish countryside of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And, it was a dramatic life shift for us. And once we got here, we really started to like it. We kind of liked being these, exile farmers, these nation farmers. And we started, getting a couple of sheep and goats. And my youngest daughter, who grew up here entirely, got into her mind that what she wanted as for her 10th birthday was a donkey. And the reason why was, it was kind of genius in a way, because she looked at a donkey and she thought, well, this is much cooler than a horse. It's not as big. It's not as scary. It's not as fast. It's a perfect kid-sized version of a riding animal. And so I kind of chewed it over. I thought, maybe we'll have an experiment. Let's just see what it's like to have a donkey. And when I began asking my neighbors, they said, actually, we know someone who has a donkey. We got to find it a new home. It's in really bad shape. And that's how we ended up taking this creature in away from a hoarder who had it locked up in a stall and then bringing it into our lives.
The donkey was in bad shape, you say?
Yeah, it was in horrific shape. It sort of gave me a glimpse, unfortunately, into the mind of animal hoarders. And, the difficulty is they don't see that they are smothering animals with their affection. So in this guy's mind, this donkey was his family, his pet, his beloved little creature. But when we saw it, this thing was locked in a dark stall, like a closet in a crumbling old barn, up to its knees in muck and manure and rotten straw. It was in horrific shape, and the look in its eyes was just lost. It looked like it was just dying in front of our eyes.
So your task suddenly became not just the purchase of a donkey, but the rehab of a donkey.
That was the thing. So as soon as we saw it, my first reaction was, well, this is not exactly the birthday gift my daughter had in mind. Maybe this is not the donkey for us. But then immediately on the tail of that thought, I just said, you know what? There's no way we're leaving it here. We're getting it out of here, which was not easy. The hoarder did not want to let it go, but we persuaded him basically that if he didn't let it go, someone else was going to take it away because that donkey was not staying in that stall one more day. But then we got to our house, and that's when we really discovered what kind of really desperate situation it was in. Its hose had outgrown so far that it couldn't walk anymore. It was like standing on skis. So the hose had were hastily long and curved up. Its teeth were falling out of its mouth. It had manure like matted into its fur. But most of all, the scariest thing of all was just that dead fish look in its eyes. It just looked like it had given up.
Was it named Sherman before it came to you, or is that something you bestowed upon it?
That was the inspiration of my youngest daughter, Sophie. So we had this kind of running mythology in the house that whatever you name the animal, that's the animal's going to turn into. So we had a cat we named Smarty Cat, and it turned out to be the most devilish cat of all. And we actually had a goat named Bamboozle, and he became a master in jumping over the fence. So she thought, we have to give this donkey a happy name, a happy name. And we'd just seen a film about the Sherman brothers, the songwriting brothers who did all the Disney songs. And she thought, Sherman, like everybody loves a Disney song. And so that's where the name Sherman came from.
Well, this saga goes such a long distance because at some point you get connected with burro racing in Colorado, I think, and that's a different part of the country. And Sherman ends up being a racing animal.
This is the pivotal moment. So here I am standing in my yard. I have this dying donkey in front of me. I don't know what to do. I'm thinking this is like the worst 10-year-old birthday party ever. And I did know we had met a woman about a year earlier. We'd seen her out in the woods near us riding her own donkey with a saddle. And so, you know, luckily in Pennsylvania, if you're a woman riding a donkey in the woods with a saddle, everybody knows who you are. So I asked around, and somebody gave me her phone number. And her name is Tanya. And Tanya just came zooming in like an avenging angel. And she took this dying donkey under her wing, and she got the hose trimmed, and she got antibiotics into him and pain relievers and cleaned him up. But at one point, she stops, and she looks me in the eye, and she says, you know, if he lives, don't just think you're going to stick him out in the field by himself. He needs something to do. This animal's been abandoned. It's feeling despair. It's like every other creature. It needs a job. You got to find him a job. And I'm kind of intimidated by this woman, so I'm kind of nodding along like, okay, yeah, all right, I'll give him a job. I mean, I don't have any job for a donkey. But the one thing I knew about was that in Colorado, to this day, there is still an old miner's tradition of pack burro racing, where people line up with their donkeys, and they run side by side with their donkeys for distances up to 29 miles.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, it's Colorado. You know, it's a weird country out there. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. So, you know, there's sort of the farcical side. It does seem kind of ridiculous. But on the sort of more evolutionary, biological side, you know, humans and donkeys are two species which are uniquely equipped to run long distances. You know, humans are amazing long-distance runners because, you know, we vent heat by perspiration instead of respiration. We are upright creatures. We're very springy. So humans are actually some of the greatest long-distance runners on Earth. And coming, you know, close behind in second place are donkeys. Donkeys are desert creatures. They evolved from the northern African deserts. So they're used to going very long distances. They have a very steady, syncopated gait. And the interesting thing about donkeys, too, is they're great teammates. They're wonderful herd animals. So if you put a bunch of donkeys and a bunch of humans together and you fire off a starting gun, you're actually going to have a really fun race on your hands. When we got this idea of trying to turn Sherman into a long-distance running donkey, I really knew that I needed some specialized help. And luckily, where we live, there is, I think, the world's only Amish marathoning club. There's a group of Amish people, men and women, who run marathons, and they train together under the full moon after work days. So I knew about this full moon Amish running club. And I reached out to them.
Okay, I'm going to just stop you here because I think I heard you say a full moon Amish running club.
Yeah, I mean, everybody doesn't have one. So here's the deal. So, you know, where we live out here in Amish country, running is not a common thing. And so the Amish guys who got interested in running, they couldn't do it during the workday. They can't go to the gym like the rest of us. So they came up with this tradition where every month they would have a run under the full moon. And this would be runs of 10 to 15 miles. And they would meet at someone's farm, and they would map out a route, and then they would just run under the moonlight. And so, you know, every month they would get about 4 or 5 days worth of good runs while the moon was still strong. And so I knew about this group, and I thought, okay, look, these guys are good runners. They know the countryside. And best of all, they really know animals. They you know, transport themselves in horse and buggies. So I reached out to the Amish running club called Bella Springa, which in Pennsylvania Dutch means let's run, and brought them out to the house. And that was a breakthrough moment because this donkey was going through a lot of life changes at this point. It had just been freed from a dungeon. It was trying to get healed, and I'm trying to turn it into a runner. And what really turned the tide around was one night we took Sherman out with Tanya's donkey, Flower, with a bunch of Amish runners, and we set off under the full moon, and off we went, and it changed everything.
I'm just trying to envision this. It's quite idyllic. It's kind of absurd, and it seems not exactly foolhardy, but this is new territory for you, isn't it?
Yeah, every step of the way is new territory. But you know, that's the beautiful thing about it. I think, you know, what this opened my eyes to was that, you know, I think in our lives we've forgotten about the integral role that animals have played in human existence. You know, we've gotten to a point in our lives where we think of animals as commodities or accessories or as kind of little fur babies that we keep in our house. But the thing was, humans and animals worked side by side as teammates for tens of thousands of years. You know, it was wild dogs and wolves, lupines, which taught humans how to track and how to hunt and how to corner quarry. We learned hunting from wolves. We would have feral cats around us at night, not just to take care of rodents, but also as an early warning alarm system. You know, we have this sense now, like when you pet a cat and it purrs and it's so cute and wonderful. But actually, that is an ancestral warning to you that a creature with far better night vision than you, with far more acute hearing, has scanned the perimeter and decided that there's no danger out there. So this is hardwired into the human psyche, except we sort of severed our bond with animals a long time ago. And what I found was the more we tried to re-embrace that relationship with Sherman with the donkey, the more my eyes opened to things of which I wish I'd known a long time ago.
There's something also about animals, and I think you concur with this, that it's not just about their being sort of our antenna out there in the world or helping us to hunt, but there's something internal in us that thrives, I would say. There's some psychological impact.
Well, here's the thing about it. If you think about 10,000 years ago, and you're an early human, you're in that cave, and you are with your wild hunting dog, and that hunting dog lies down next to you and closes its eyes. That's a signal to you that it's safe for you to also close your eyes. And the thing about it is, anything that is good for the survival of the human species, your brain is going to become hardwired to reinforce that behavior. So if that kind of a contact with a wild dog is going to be good for the human species, then your brain is going to reaffirm that by giving you that soothing burst of endorphins, of serotonin, oxytocin, all those hormones that flood through your body to tell you this is a good behavior, let's keep it up. So the thing about us as humans is, you know, we still have the bodies of early humans. You know, our technology has changed, but our physical beings have not really changed very much. So the body you're inhabiting today is not very different than the body your ancestors had 2,000 years ago. The difference is that we've radically changed our day-to-day lifestyle. But if you take a dog right now into a cancer ward, you can measure pain levels, and pain levels will drop in half. Anxiety levels drop in half. You take animals into classrooms with behaviorally challenged children, and all of a sudden behavior improves. So
this is a natural medicinal remedy that's right at our disposal, and yet we sort of forgot about it. We forgot how important that contact with the animal kingdom really can be for us.
So has Sherman the donkey then made you better, made your daughter better, had a beneficial impact on anybody else in your community?
Well, listen, I'll let a different jury decide whether I'm better, but I will tell you a story that was really profoundly moving to us. In the middle of this process of trying to train Sherman to be a long-distance running donkey, the first thing we realized was we're going to have to throw more donkeys at the problem. Having one donkey wasn't going to work. Donkeys are herd animals. So we ended up taking in two of Tanya's donkeys, and so we had a herd of three. But that meant we also needed three runners. So my wife stepped up as a volunteer. And then out of the blue, we got a call from a family friend whose son was a student at Penn State and was having a really desperate struggle with clinical depression, so bad that he had to take time away at home. And he wanted to join us to do some running. He didn't even know about the donkeys at this point. So Zeke showed up just because he wanted to get some exercise and try to turn his mental state around through some exercise. And I said, okay, you can run with us, but it's going to involve a donkey. And Zeke was all for it. And almost immediately, the most damaged animal formed a link with the most damaged person. Zeke and Sherman just took a look at each other, and they go, all right, that's it. You're for me. I didn't want Zeke running with Sherman. I wanted him with one of the other donkeys who was actually a little more stable. But as soon as Zeke and Sherman teamed up, that was it. They were inseparable. And the transformation that both of them underwent over the next 4 months was just heartwarming and really amazing.
Now, is the running here focused on just getting out and being with the animals and running as a runner will run, or the races, the competitions?
I wrestled with this, and my thinking was, if it was just going to be recreational, just a little bit of tootling around every day, it's too easy to lose focus and motivation. And the thing that this donkey needed was to get really challenging movement all the time. The problem with donkeys is that if they're not moving, if they're not churning their legs, they can't actually digest their food. They're really at risk of seizing up. They have having their intestines solidify. It's a really common problem with animals which are kept in barns, horses and donkeys, because they'll develop colic and they'll literally explode from the inside out. So we knew that this donkey was in such dire condition that it really needed to move and move a lot and every day. And I thought, you know what? If we have a goal that we're aiming for, if we have a deadline, a ticking clock, that's really going to get us out there every day. So that's when I got the idea of, rather than just trying to jog a little bit with this donkey every day, let's give us a date with destiny 1 year from today where we've got to be ready to run 29 miles in the Rocky Mountains with these animals, because that's what's going to really get us out the door every day.
Talk to me about staying power, keeping the donkey in your life for the long term.
Well, I'll tell you, listen, before anybody ever adopts a donkey, you got to ask yourself two questions. Number one, how old is this donkey? And number two, what's the expected lifespan of a donkey? neither question I ever thought to ask before signing on to this operation. So it turns out, do you know what the average lifespan of a donkey is?
I have no idea.
60 years.
Oh, my.
60 years. And you know how old Sherman was? 8. So, you know, talking about staying power. I got another 50 years with this operation looking at me. So,
Well, the way you describe him, though, it sounds as though there's a familial connection here between human and animal.
Oh, it's a funny thing. It's something I never expected. They are so affectionate. Exactly the sort of soulful look you notice in your friend's rescue donkey, that's what it is about them. If I go out in the yard right now and sit outside in the grass with a book, in a matter of 5 minutes, the donkey will be wandering over, dropping their heads on my shoulder, nuzzling up. They are like gigantic, big-eared kittens, very affectionate, very cuddly, and very, very lovable.
Christopher McDougall there. McDougall is best-selling author of Born to Run, Natural Born Heroes, and Running with Sherman. So donkey therapy, it's fairly unusual by comparison to horse therapy. Horse therapy more firmly established, it has traction and cachet. We're going to finish off our hour on the show now with how horses can be healing for humans. A highlight from Tim Hayes, who is an equine therapy expert. Hayes is author of Riding Home, The Power of Horses to Heal.
What I discovered was we have in America a large herd of wild Mustangs that roam free in Utah, Nevada, Idaho. There's probably 50,000 of them. And they're managed by the U.S. government. And there's always been a controversy about how to keep them from overpopulating, taking over the cattle ranch's land. And people have said, why don't we euthanize them? And nobody wants to kill horses. And they couldn't figure out what to do. And about 25 years ago, someone said, you know, we teach inmates to make license plates. Why don't we teach them how to gentle horses? And then we can give these horses up for adoption to people. And that's, in fact, what they did. And they started a program called the Wild Horse Inmate Program, where they would gather up wild Mustangs, bring them into prisons where there was a horseman, a cowboy who was a horse trainer, who then taught the inmates the method that I'm explaining to you, how to deal and gentle with a horse so that the horse became tame. He wasn't dangerous because he wasn't wild anymore. And then actually, any U.S. citizen can adopt a horse today for $125. All you have to do is go online and look up the Wild Horse Inmate Program, and you can find a horse. What happened, though, when I went out to observe, I spent a week out in a prison in Colorado, was I saw something really that I did not expect. The inmates were trying to gentle the horses. And a lot of these inmates were real tough men from inner cities like Chicago and New York City, and they had lived their whole life with hardness and violence. But the wild horse is far more intimidating than a human. And all of a sudden, I saw that the inmates were starting to get gentle by the horses. I had a conversation with one inmate in particular named Morris. And I said, Morris, what's this like for you? You've never been with a horse before. He said, well, I have to tell you something I've never told anybody. That horse looks like it's trying to hurt me, and it's very violent. But you know what? He looks scared. And it reminded me of myself because, Tim, I've been violent and tough my whole life. That's how I stayed alive in Los Angeles. But I've never told anybody, but I've always been afraid. And I can see why the horse is doing what he's doing. And I thought to myself, here's a guy in prison who, because of a horse, is learning the ability of compassion, how to feel for another being. What an incredible thing.
Tim Hayes, an equine therapy expert. He's author of Riding Home, The Power of Horses to Heal. On Monday, here on the show, the questions behind the questions as to whether or not Mars has or ever has had life, you know, stuff living there on Mars. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.